Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 696, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This program has been recorded on December 6th of the year 2009. And, you know, as I contemplate the passage of time here, I think that rather than go into an article which talks about American creationists, including a front for the Moon Organization, the Unification Church, networking with Islamist creationists, I think I'm going to go directly to an interview. I'm going to read a transcript of an interview that was done on Australian Broadcasting, specifically the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. And what we're going to do is to read a fellow named, I'm going to read the text of an interview between Stephen Crittenden, the host of this Religion Report program, and an American author named Jeff Charlotte. Now, Jeff Charlotte has written a book about a Christian fundamentalist group in the United States called The Family, which is an extremely powerful and very secretive organization. His book is beginning to get a certain amount of traction, and it's the flogging process that any author goes about with a new book is being successful up to the point. And what we're going to basically do is to read this interview that Stephen Crittenden had with Jeff Charlotte, in which he synopsizes to a certain extent what The Family is. Now, The Family is a Protestant organization. In the past, we've spoken at great length about fascist organizations within the Vatican, such as Opus Dei and the aforementioned P2 Lodge that we were talking about on Side 2. The P2 isn't actually a Vatican organization, but heavily overlaps the Vatican. And what we're going to look at in this program, in this next section of this program, concerns The Family. Now, The Family, again, is fundamentalist Christian. It has very, very strong links into the American power structure. It is, to a certain extent, bipartisan, in that people such as Hillary Clinton have fallen to a certain extent under the sway of The Family. It is very well connected. It has much to do with the administration of American power structure, and it has some very, very strong fascist antecedents and inclinations, and indeed it was begun in the 1930s by a Norwegian immigrant who was also very close to, among other institutions, Henry Ford, or among other individuals, Henry Ford, one of Adolf Hitler's earliest financial backers. As we're going to see, not only did The Family adopt certain fascist and Nazi ideas in the 30s, it also was employed by elements of the U.S. government to aid in the rehabilitation of Nazis for their subsequent inclusion in the post-World War II German government and also economic structure. Now, the following is an interview from Australian television with Stephen Crittenden and Jeff Charlotte, and I'm going to go ahead and simply read this interview in its entirety. Stephen Crittenden introduces the book, The Family, and author Jeff Charlotte as follows. A dramatic moment from the movie There Will Be Blood, based on a novel by Upton Sinclair, which won an Oscar last year for the glowering Daniel Day-Lewis. If you've seen the movie, you'll know it's an allegory depicting the clash between two very different sides of American society, the religious side and the capitalist side. If they seem to mix all too comfortably together these days, There Will Be Blood is a reminder that it wasn't always so. Today's program is really the story of how those two sides came together. It's the story of a shadowy religious organization known as the Fellowship or the Family, founded in the 1930s by a Norwegian immigrant to the United States named Abraham Vereide, V-E-R-E-I-D-E. He believed that the best way to change the world was to minister to business and political leaders, powerful men like Henry Ford, who weren't much interested in the churches. And again, as we've seen interrupting in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, Henry Ford was one of Hitler's earliest and most prominent financial backers, as well as a prominent underwriter of fascist causes in the United States. Continuing with Stephen Crittenden's interview of Jeff Charlotte. A bit like a Protestant version of Opus Dei, the Fellowship is basically theocratic in impulse and deeply hostile to democracy. And over decades, it has managed to penetrate to the very center of American political power by preaching a gospel of American power. In the 1950s, the fellowship established a national prayer breakfast, and now every week in Washington, business leaders and politicians from all sides sit down to read the Bible and pray together. The current leader of the family is the reclusive Doug Coe, described by Hillary Clinton as, quote, a genuinely loving spiritual mentor and guide to anyone, regardless of party or faith, who wants to deepen his or her relationship with God, unquote. As we'll hear, Doug Coe is also an admirer of Hitler, Lenin, and Mao. Jeff Charlotte is a contributing editor for Harper's and Rolling Stone, an association research scholar in the Center for Religion and Media at New York University, and he's the author of a new book about the fellowship entitled The Family, Politics, Power, and Fundamentalism's Shadow Elite. It's based on research he did on documents kept at the Billy Graham Center archives, and it's one of the most absorbing books I've read all year. Jeff Charlotte says when we think of American Christian fundamentalism, we tend to think of the populist, Bible-thumping TV evangelists. But the fellowship is about a very different kind of fundamentalism, elite fundamentalism. More upper class, more sophisticated, it doesn't need the media doing its work behind the scenes. And then Jeff Charlotte speaks here for the first time. Elite fundamentalism, and especially the elite fundamentals in the family, is not so much interested in holding mass rallies or saving everybody's souls. Rather, it grows out of this belief that took hold in the 1930s that God works through a few specially chosen individuals. They call them key men, the sort of anointed. And there's the real concerns, well, not social issues, but economic, something that they came to call biblical capitalism, a sort of laissez-faire capitalism, and especially foreign affairs. And I think that comes as a surprise to a lot of folks here in the United States, but also overseas. But they're the kind of Christian fundamentalism in America that has always taken as its main concern the role of American power in the world and the expansion of that kind of power. And it sounds sort of like a biblical corporatism here. Of course, Mussolini's corporate state being how he defined fascism, he being the first fascist. Then Stephen Crittenden goes on. Now, the book is basically about a shadowy organization called the Family, or the Fellowship, that was founded by a guy called Abraham Vereide, a Norwegian immigrant to the United States in the 1930s. Tell us about him and the foundation of this organization. Jeff Charlotte. Vereide is a fascinating character. This guy who comes to America from Norway because he sees America as the land of the Bible unchained. Even from a boy, he's given to what he thinks are prophetic visions. He believes that God comes to him and talks to him in very literal words. He comes to America, and he makes quite a name for himself, becomes a preacher, and starts preaching to guys like Henry Ford and titans of the steel industry and so on. And then he has this epiphany, this realization in the middle of our Great Depression in the 1930s. He decides that the Great Depression is actually a punishment from God for disobeying God's law. And how are we disobeying God's law? Well, it's because we are trying to regulate the economy. We are trying to take matters into our own hands. Well, we just have to completely trust God, and thus he chooses men like Henry Ford and the CEO of U.S. Steel and so on. And, of course, interrupting by extension, we're supposed to trust them as well. Stephen Crittenden, yes, it's a muscular Christianity. You'd almost say he had a ministry to bring that industrial class back into religion. Jeff Charlotte, absolutely right. This must be a Christianity on steroids. They were building on this tradition of this kind of macho Christ and taking it to these businessmen who didn't really care about church or the Bible or anything like that. What they cared about was organized labor, and in fact, particularly on Australia, men like Harry Bridges was a major, major labor leader here in the United States, and they just saw in him the devil incarnate and began to organize against him. And that's what this group has become. And that's what they are to this day. They still see God's interests as those of the absolutely unregulated free markets, a very sort of macho, muscular Christianity that tends to serve the interests of those involved. I would say, basically, a corporatist Christianity. continuing with this interview, Stephen Crittenden. As I was reading the book, I was constantly reminded of the Catholic elite fundamentalist organization Opus Dei, which was founded just a couple of years before the family and clearly had a political program. There seemed to be very interesting similarities between them. Jeff Charlotte. There really are striking similarities between Opus Dei and the family. They were actually both founded at this moment when conservative Catholics in the case of Opus Dei and conservative Protestants in the case of the family conclude that democracy is done, that it's spent, that it can't compete with these incredibly vigorous forces of communism and fascism. By the way, parenthetically, the family or fellowship was founded in the 30s. Both Opus Dei and the Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamic fascist organization, were founded in 1928. They were both founded in the same year. And so, by the way, there have been a lot of programs that we've done in the past about Opus Dei. So use the Spitfire List website. Continuing with the interview and jumping back in with Jeff Charlotte's observation here. And there's a mistaken idea that the Opus Dei and also the family wanted to be just fascist. No, they didn't want to be fascist. They saw a lot to admire in fascism, but they wanted to create their own religious way where fascism sort of idolized the character like Hitler and Mussolini, and they said, no, we want that same kind of cult of personality, that same kind of muscular politics and religion, but we want it to be centered around Jesus. Well, of course, who's Jesus? And that's when you run into the very real religious horror story of this book, which is that they read the same Bible that most of the rest of us do, but they take a very different message, one that's not about mercy or justice or love or forgiveness, but rather it is about power. And very literally, when I looked through the family's papers, 600 boxes of documents, that's what they saw in the New Testament as the bottom line, was this message of power, and it's striking, I think, and unsettling to even most conservative Christians. Stephen Crittenden. So much to talk about in what you've just said to unpack. Let's talk about the theological question about Jesus first. You speak about a theology which you say is totally malleable, and you talk about a theology of Jesus plus nothing. It's almost like a homegrown American religion that purports to be about Jesus, purports to be Christian, but it's had all the content drained out of it. Charlotte. Yes, that's really exactly it. I begin the book and I begin the story with a month I spent living in one of the family's houses where they sort of groom younger men for leadership by signing you up for mentoring with a congressman and so on. And I remember being struck at the time when a U.S. Senate aide was telling us about former Vice President Dan Quayle, who had volunteered to lead a Bible study for political men for the family, but he needed some help. He needed someone to come over and give him just a quick crash course because, he said, well, he hadn't actually ever read the Bible. This, by the way, former Vice President Dan Potato Quayle, potato with an E, Quayle. Continuing, so he was certain he knew what the Bible said. He was quite certain it supported his political program. He felt confident in scolding others for not living up to the Bible, but he had never actually read the Bible. And that's what you really see when you look at this elite fundamentalism. It's a religion of the status quo. It's a religion of things as they are. It's not the sort of science fiction vision of what the world will look like when the fundamentalists have taken over. These guys are very content with the world as it is, and they top up the Bible as something that is supporting themselves and power. Doug Coe, the leader of the group, says, quote, we work with power where we can, we build new power where we can't, unquote. And that's a very status quo religion. Crittenden. The next big question is to unpack where the religious program ends and the political program begins. Charlotte, you know, I like to sort of think of it as a Mobius strip. You know, that popular optical illusion of a ribbon that's sort of twisting and you can never figure out which side you're on. There is no clear line where the religion ends and the politics begin. They don't draw the distinction. I'll give you an example of the project they did recently, something called the Silk Road Act. This is a piece of American legislation passed in 1999 by our Senator Sam Brownback and Congressman Joe Pitts, both members of the family. Parenthetically, in a recent program dealing with Opus Dei, Vatican Rag Part 2, we dealt with Senator Brownback as also a champion of Opus Dei in the U.S. Congress. So he also, to a certain extent, has pursued the agenda of Opus Dei, as well as, according to this, being a member of the family. Continuing, of the Silk Road Act passed by the family. The Silk Road Act directed U.S. funds to the dictatorships of the Central Asian region, and as Senator Brownback explained to me, his role was to essentially buy these countries off, to open them up to free markets by giving them a lot of money, a sort of an odd concept of free markets. And the reason he wanted to do this is that we have free markets where capitalism follows the gospel. And so there you have economics, you have politics, and you have religion, and they're all caught in this loop. And then Crittenden says, Jeff, let's go back to the early history of the family and look in more detail at its political program during the 1930s and 1940s, which seems to focus primarily on destroying trade unionism in the United States, and in that, they completely succeeded. And so again, take a look at what the family was up to in the 30s and 40s. And Charlotte goes on, yes, they really did. I mean, I think that again, that takes me back to this question. People always ask, what do the fundamentalists want to do? I think the more relevant question is, what have the fundamentalists already done? And you look in the United States and say, why do we alone in the developed world not have a serious organized labor movement? Our organized labor movement is nowhere near as powerful and influential as yours here in Australia. I think we really have to look to groups like the family and elite fundamentalism. They came into being opposed to organized labor, worked steadily at that, and counted as one of their first big victories a law that was passed here in 1947, which essentially rolled back many of the rights to organize and to form unions that had been won under Franklin Roosevelt. They counted that as their first victory, and then they just sort of went forward from there and played this role of driving the center to the right. They were very involved in the Cold War, very involved in the economics of globalization. These are their projects, but they see them as religious ends. Crittenden, you mentioned that in these years the family was attracted by fascist and even Nazi ideas. And you say that in the immediate aftermath of World War II, they were involved in rehabilitating key Nazi industrialists and bankers, helping them out or even bringing them to the United States. Charlotte, that was their first big step overseas. That's when they became international, during the Second World War. Abraham Varide, the founder, actually traveled to the Allied prisons in Germany where we were holding the prisoners of war with a mandate from the United States State Department to go among these Nazis and sort of interview them and decide which ones could be used for rebuilding Germany. And they brought in quite a few scary characters, perhaps the most notable of whom was Hermann Josef Abs, who, after Varide and the family had vouched for him, rose to become the chief financial wizard behind West Germany's rise, enjoying a very successful career into the 1970s, until the Simon Wiesenthal Center discovered that before he had been known as Germany's banker, he had been known as Hitler's banker, and he had helped spirit uncounted sums of money off to the Nazis who escaped to Latin America. He was a bad guy and he was driven out of politics, but that was the role that the family was playing, and it was whitewashing these guys and getting these guys back into power because they wanted them for the Cold War. Pausing here briefly, now of course Hermann Josef Abs was indeed one of the most important of the Third Reich's bankers. He was indeed rehabilitated. You can read about him at great length, for example, in the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by the late Paul Manning. That's available for download for free on my website. We talked about Hermann Abs in our discussions with John Loftus about his book Unholy Trinity. And in addition to having been rehabilitated, apparently, through the good auspices of the family, Hermann Abs also was deeply involved with it, helping to advise as the Vatican's financial networks as well. And indeed, when the Vatican financial scandals broke in the early 1990s, it was none other than Hermann Josef Abs who was called in to help straighten that mess out. So again, note that just as Senator Brownback, an actual member of the family, according to this document, also has worked with Opus Dei, the Catholic organization described by Jeff Charlotte as being very similar to the family, so too Hermann Abs was rehabilitated to an extent as a result of the efforts of the family, and yet also became a Vatican financial advisor as well. And next, the interview goes on to talk about some of the things that the family has been involved in after World War II. But again, note that they were attracted by fascist and Nazi ideas and that they were involved in rehabilitating key Nazi industrialists and bankers. Now we know who, in what milieu that places the family, don't we, folks? Can you say Bormann, boys and girls? Continuing with Jeff Charlotte. Actually, Stephen Crittenden then goes on to talk about the family's role in establishing the National Prayer Breakfast. Crittenden, Jeff, I guess the most public face of the family or the fellowship in the last 30, 40, or 50 years has been the fact that it created the National Prayer Breakfast, and you tell the story of how President Eisenhower really officiated at the first National Prayer Breakfast a bit reluctantly. He's a bit like a John McCain figure, not very comfortable with overt displays of religion. Charlotte, yes, exactly. In 1953, the fellowship inaugurated the National Prayer Breakfast, which has been held in Washington ever since. The United States president always attends, Congress attends, and they set these up around the world. You even have one here in Australia. And they've been this sort of very they've been sort of very deliberately banal events, very bland. But they refer to within the group, they are referred to within the group and in their documents as recruiting devices to identify and bring people into closer involvement. And the family had wanted to do this for many years, but the previous U.S. presidents wouldn't do it. President Eisenhower didn't want to do it. He said it's a violation of separation of church and state, which is a fundamental part of our Constitution here, unquote. But Billy Graham and a senator who was involved with the family, Frank Carlson, had organized an evangelical Christian vote for him, and they wanted payback, so Eisenhower went, concerned that this was going to become a tradition, and indeed it did. And now, it doesn't matter who's elected here in November, whether it's McCain or Obama, come February, they're going to the National Prayer Breakfast. And what that does is it gives the family that kind of power and that draw. It doesn't mean that every president signs off on their beliefs, but they're able to go around and say, look at this, we're able to bring the President of the United States to one of our events. Don't you want to be associated with that? Crittenden. And is the National Prayer Breakfast then the key instrument of the family's power? That again, Stephen Crittenden and Charlotte answers. I think the key instrument is this really incredible network of politicians they've built up over the years. I mean, you look back across American history, and you find guys like Chief Justice William Rehnquist, who's one of the most influential conservative chief justices of our Supreme Court. The old legendary Dixiecrat named Strom Thurmond was a longtime right-winger. Even now, I can give you a long list of American politicians, and there have been Australian politicians involved as well, and folks around the world. They're able to build this network so that if you want to get something done, it's very helpful to work through the family. Crittenden, you've got to tell us who the Australians are. Charlotte. By the way, that's Jeff Charlotte. It's not the woman's first name. Well, the Australians are going back in history. The first guy to get involved was the man named Norman Macon, who was actually not considered a right-winger. He was a longtime ambassador to the United States, but was an early Cold Warrior and saw the family as a useful vehicle for working with the conservative side of American politics during the Cold War. More recently, I would just bump into, in the documents, minor Australian politicians, Bruce Baird, a fellow named Ross Cameron, and I suppose Peter Costello has been involved, and I don't know how involved. That's just something I followed up on. Then another participant asks, who is Doug Coe? Here he is on videotapes obtained exclusively by NBC News with his account of atrocities under Chairman Mao. Doug Coe, I've seen pictures of the young man in the Red Guard. They would bring in this young man's mother. He would take an axe and cut her head off. They have to put the purposes of the Red Guard ahead of their father, mother, brother, sister, and their own life. That was a covenant, a pledge. That's what Jesus said. Woman, in his preaching, he repeatedly urges a personal commitment to Jesus Christ, a commitment compares to the blind devotion Adolf Hitler demanded. Crittenden. NBC News reporting on the reclusive leader of the family, Pastor Doug Coe. Jeff, you say that the family has penetrated American politics so thoroughly that even someone like Hillary Clinton has to be part of these prayer breakfasts. It doesn't really matter what side of politics you're on. The family isn't interested in that. So again, noting that the tactics of the Red Guard, as well as the devotion shown Adolf Hitler by members of the Nazi Party, are seen as good role models for the sort of attraction that Coe feels should be devoted to Jesus. And again, Crittenden was quoting from an NBC News, or was playing an excerpt of an NBC News interview with Doug Coe. And then there's discussion here of Hillary Clinton and her connections still to the family, and skipping down. You mentioned the Reverend Billy Graham earlier. He's a very interesting character in this story, as he only appears once or twice, but he's obviously pivotal at the beginning of setting up the National Prayer Breakfast, as you mentioned. He shoehorns President Eisenhower into sort of turning it up and playing along. What is Billy Graham's role in all of this? He strikes me as a much more complex and ambiguous character than he sometimes seems on the surface. Charlotte, he really is. He really is a complicated character, which is interesting because he was not a complicated man. I'm sorry, was not, put in the past tense, still alive, still with us, but mostly his public career was over. He was a simple man who found himself at the nexus of a lot of power and was a little bit proud of that. You know, I mean, I was able to put together the account of his role in the National Prayer Breakfast, not just through these documents which are in the archives, but through his own biography, in which he really comes right out and boasts about bullying President Eisenhower into this role. He was a guy who came from a very right-wing fundamentalist place, a very anti-Semitic place, which he never really quite overcomes, and moved into the mainstream of American life and was instrumental, for instance, in giving religious cover to President Nixon, and also played this very important role for the family. And again, he's talking about Billy Graham here. There is, of course, a long history of association between Protestant fundamentalism and fascism. In the book, The Nazis Go Underground, one of the things that Kurt Rees talked about was that he felt that in attempting to go underground, the Third Reich would hook up with American fundamentalists. I would also note that, among others, the late Reverend Norman Vincent Peale, author of The Power of Positive Thinking, helped to... He fronted for an Axis spy named Edward Rumley during World War II. That's in the description to the book Undercover by John Roy Carlson. And, of course, Nazi spy chief Reinhard Gehlen, after his formal exit from the BND, the German Intelligence Service, became a religious evangelist or pursued an evangelical religion. So, again, the family, a very, very interesting organization and an apparent major power nexus in Washington, D.C., but relatively quiet as it is influential. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 696. Miscellaneous articles and updates. This program is being recorded on December 6th of 2009. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.